In fact, I should probably, you know, at the very top of the episode put up, I cannot speak Welsh. I am not a native Welsh speaker. I will do my best, but if people want to come at me and say it's terrible, I already know.
But at least you tried Welsh, which is the better part of the thing. You're at least trying to use the Welsh words.
I'm trying to use some. And actually, as per your request, I'm going to try and use three Welsh words right up top here.
Okay.
So your three words for this episode. Anta. Okay. Afon.
Uh-huh.
And Saloch.
One of them, I believe, means apple.
Unfortunately, no.
No, then I'm wrong.
But I like the confidence with which you threw that out there. Now, I can give you them in English as well, because I think it's a bit unfair to expect you to translate the Welsh. So the three words are adventure.
Okay.
River.
Okay.
Although maybe that should be rivers, plural. Right. And illness.
Yeah, I have no idea who this is. Good job. You found someone I didn't know.
Well, we'll see, because technically he should be very, very famous. And I'm hoping with your history knowledge that maybe you'll pick him up, but we'll see how we go.
Okay.
Hey up, I'm Joe Heathcote, and this is Consistently Eccentric, a British history podcast where we try to make sense of some of the lesser known and more absurd people and events these islands have produced. So let's get started with... Because this story starts between 35,000 and 13,000 years ago.
BC!
Yeah, we're way BC.
Ali is so jealous, I'm sure.
This is the second furthest back we've gone. Ever.
Okay. Ever.
Because at some point within that rather loose time frame, a group of hunters from Asia made their way across a land bridge between Siberia and Alaska that had formed thanks to the last ice age before steadily spreading across the continents of North and South America.
Yeah, you knew that. No one else seems to know that.
I will point out that that sort of humanization of the Americas coincided with a massive extinction event in America. I'm not saying the two things are related, but suddenly there were a lot less big animals around once the humans moved in. Because, you know, they didn't know to fear us at that point, so...
Yes.
More fool them. Now, these peoples, they developed distinct societies and cultures. However, because they were not European, history has generally not given them the credit for discovering America.
That's true.
They got there too early. They were ahead of the curve. Just too far ahead of the curve, really. Generally, though, the argument over who actually discovered America pits the Vikings, specifically Leif Erikson, against Christopher Columbus.
Yes. Leif Erikson discovered Canada. Leif Erikson discovered Canada.
Oh.
Christopher Columbus.
Is that how we're splitting it?
No, but that's how they can make it make sense.
Right. Well, the Nordic countries are generally more icy, so maybe he just felt more at home in Canada than he might have done further down the eastern seaboard there. Leif is said to have completed his journey around 1000 AD, while Christopher Columbus arrived, as I'm sure you know, in 1492. When he sailed the ocean blue.
With three ships.
Never mind the fact he was searching for India. He found something. Yes. And he made the best of, you know, he made the best of what he found. I think he really was a good publicist for himself. Because how many places in America are called Columbus or have some link to him?
Oh my goodness, so many.
Does pretty much every state have their own?
I'm sure. And we have Italian Catholics, a lot of Italian Catholics, and they love Christopher Columbus.
Well, why wouldn't your local boy done good? You gotta respect that.
That's right. That's right.
Now, there is evidence of a Viking settlement, but it's on Newfoundland Island.
In Canada.
But even with that, I'd be even more pedantic and say that that's not even discovering the continent properly. It's like saying, you know, you found Britain and you went, oh, I found Europe. Not quite. You got close. Very close. But I don't think I can give him the credit for that.
Yeah. No, I visited there, so that's why I know about it, too.
Oh, fantastic. Have you visited the Viking settlement?
I have.
Oh, wow. What was it like?
Well, it's a reenactment, so it's not even like the actual buildings anymore, but they try to recreate it like it was. So it was okay.
I know the one in York, if you've ever been to the Jorvik Viking Centre. You get on, like...
I've not been to the York Viking Centre, but I was on the York Wall, and there's parts of the wall. They go, this was Viking! This was Roman! This was this!
Now, yeah. It all looks like wall to me. You could be saying anything at this point. But no,
I know.
Just going to ask, because in the Jorvik, when you go around the village, you go on a little, like, almost a tiny roller coaster kind of setup, but they pipe in smells of, like, a Viking thing. So there's lots of smells of manure and other terrible smells as you go past the latrines and stuff. I was just wondering if the one in Newfoundland replicated the smell-o-vision element.
No, ours is more like going through, like, Jamestown. It's just a reenactment village where you go in little huts. And there's, like, a person in there making something or cooking something. Or there's nothing in there. And it's like, here's a bowl they might have used. This is how the houses might have looked. Mm-hmm. This is how small they were. They fit 7 families in this house. Like that. It's not, there's no. But, I mean, the smell thing, you have now convinced me to go back to York. Because I was done with it. But there you go.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Where else are you going to get to smell authentic Viking effluence?
Oh, I don't know, but you've intrigued me now.
I know that Em went to one of those reenactments when she went to America, and she said that the one thing as an English person that was quite off-putting was the people trying to put on a British accent that kind of veered wildly through, like,
yes,
all of the different counties. And it's fair enough. I mean, I can't do an American accent and sort of place it in a particular place, but she said it was very unnerving.
All Americans think all the Scottish sound the same and that Geordies and Scottish sound the same. I didn't realize until recently that Scrooge McDuck is a sound dancer. He is not Scottish. Ruined my childhood. But that's what it is.
Yeah.
But I know the difference between a Geordie accent and a Scottish accent, and I can never tell them apart. I never tell them they're the same again. So, yeah.
Once you get maybe half an hour above us into sort of Cumbria, it gets very convoluted, but that's just because, you know, places like Carlisle, right on the border, it was Scottish as much as it was English, because they just kept changing hands, so they needed a hybrid sort of accent that covered everything, so it didn't really matter.
And that's why I asked where you were from, because I couldn't place you.
Okay. Yeah. Which means that Columbus should get all of the credit, right?
Yes.
Except there is, in fact, another claimant to being the first European to set foot on American soil. Specifically, okay, a Welsh prince called Madoc.
I've heard of him, but not enough that I can do better than you. Go ahead.
Despite being the son of legendary Welsh king Owain Gwynedd, Madoc was illegitimate. He was acknowledged by his father, but he was still illegitimate. And when his father died in 1170, he was one of over 20 legitimate and bastard children who could theoretically make a claim for the throne. So the succession hadn't been quite worked out as smoothly as maybe it should have been. And while a number of the kids did try to take the top spot, with the kingdom eventually being split in two, so as that David and Rodri could both call themselves king, because they made a pact, it was like, we'll beat everyone else and then we'll just split it down the middle. Which is quite good for siblings. I wouldn't trust any of my brothers with a deal like that. I'd know that he was going to stab me in the back and take it all, so... Fair play to David and Rodri, you know, having that trust between them. Madoc, though, he reportedly decided that it'd just be best to get away from the whole succession thing until it was settled down. So he decided he'll get in a boat with some loyal friends and the families and go travelling. They sailed west, skirted round Ireland, and headed out into the unknown of the Atlantic Ocean.
What year is this?
This is 1170. This is
AD or BC?
This is AD. So this is slap bang between Leif Erikson. He would have got there 170 years earlier. And then you've got another 250, 300 years. And then you've got... Legend states that when Madoc and his followers arrived on the coast of America, they were so impressed by what they found that they made a decision that this was going to be where they were going to set up a new Welsh kingdom. So this was extreme West Wales from then on, as far as they were concerned.
Yeah, we could even speak in Welsh. Mm. Wow.
Well, when they encountered the locals, Madoc, he immediately saw the benefit in cooperation, and rather than starting a war, his followers quickly adapted to the indigenous way of life, sharing knowledge and intermarrying, until eventually the two peoples became one. a unique Welsh-speaking tribe who used coracle boats. So those are the, you know, the round boats that make no sense, where you just have one paddle.
Yes.
Yeah, and you look at them and think, how was that the most practical design you could come up with? But apparently
they're Welsh. Okay, that explains it.
Apparently they're seafaring craft, those coracles. I always thought they were just for like rivers and stuff, but no, apparently you could take them out to sea, which seems sketchy as all. I don't think I'd want to.
Does this mention lacrosse as well? Because I think lacrosse, we were told, is a Native American game, but now I think it's a Welsh game based on what you're telling me.
Well, there's a lot of Gaelic games that look close to lacrosse. So there are a bunch of Gaelic sports that are played sort of in Ireland.
But now you're telling me, if I think we've been lied to, and lacrosse is not a Native American game, it's based off of this Welsh guy showing up and intermingling with the natives.
Mm. I couldn't tell you. I've never really seen the appeal of lacrosse. It looks very dangerous because that ball looks incredibly hard.
Well, I only play badminton, really.
Ah, there you go. You're not going to get hurt with a shuttlecock.
With a shuttlecock, no.
Unless someone's got one hell of a swing. So they jumped in,
sorry,
full bore into the native lifestyle, and they said, you know what, this is parrot. We don't want to ruin what you've got. It's obviously a good thing here, so we're just going to take your lead, be one of the gang, away we go. By going native rather than seeking conquest, you could argue that the Madoc story didn't really matter in the history of America as a whole. And indeed, it was largely ignored even in the UK. That was until Queen Elizabeth I was on the throne.
Good Queen Bess.
She had need of this legendary tale. Because the Spanish and the French were starting to make claims on the American continents, both north and south, and the English were worried that they might miss out on the colonising rush. You know, it's one of those things, once, if you're not the first person there to call dibs.
Of course.
You've got to use the traditional British sort of tactics of conniving, lying, sneaking in when no one's looking, and that's more difficult than if you can just claim it at the outset. That's where you want to be involved. And in order to put forward the argument that the entirety of America should be owned by the English, the story of Madoc was resurrected by Elizabeth's personal astronomer and magician, John Dee.
Yes, John Dee.
Who was also a Welshman. So again, a case of that nationalistic pride. Don't you worry, Elizabeth. We have rights to this continent, and do you know why? Because of a Welshman.
You've now gained 3 more followers to your podcast by just mentioning his name. Go on.
Well, he used the Madoc story as evidence that the continent had already been claimed by Wales, which had then been subjugated by England, meaning that Queen Elizabeth was the rightful monarch of the entire continent. Over the next 250 years, more scholars embellished the story of Madoc, and as information about America began to travel back across the sea to Europe, it was decided that he must have travelled up the Mississippi River and then onward up the Missouri River after his sea voyage, before meeting the tribe whom he and his followers would join. So now we've got a sense of the location of where they are, you know, towards the northern areas of America over near the Rockies is where, that's the vague
the
area. Yeah, well, that's where we think, the flyover zone is where we think he decided to set up.
In the Midwest, okay.
Yeah.
Sure.
And indeed, the settlers of the eastern coast of America, as they began to explore further into the interior, reports began to come back to the cities of tribes of Native Americans who they swore were speaking Welsh. And while it was true that the settlers making these claims were not native Welsh speakers themselves, meaning that they had no way of knowing if the language was truly Welsh, or just used a lot of consonants, as Welsh tends to, this apparent confirmation that it had been a Welshman who had first settled America gave the Welsh a sense of pride, and it was used to stir up nationalistic feelings by Welsh separatist movements. Because of all the countries of the UK, the Welsh have definitely had it the worst from the English. We subjugated them early.
Yes.
And while the Scots were always able to kind of retreat to the Highlands and then force the English back, the Welsh didn't have enough of the rugged countryside to retreat into. So they just got wiped out quite early on.
And then they had the French attack them.
Yes, they did have the French attack them that one time. But I think everyone was embarrassed by that.
Favourite episode is the French one. Okay.
Oh, yes. Okay. Gosh. The last invasion of Britain. It's fantastic.
Yes. Whatever number that is, go look it up.
The Welsh are also the last ever armed revolt in Great Britain took place in Wales in Newport. So they've always been a very sort of proud people and of people who believe that they've not been given a fair shake, which is completely justified.
And it doesn't help that no one can pronounce Welsh correctly.
Mm. Well, even the word Welsh literally means foreign. When you go back to the origin of the word, it's basically just a catch-all for foreigners that you're slightly annoyed by. And they kind of reclaim the word. But all of this brings us to April 14th, 1770, when a young boy called John Evans was born in a little cottage on a small holding outside of the town of Hwanfor, near the western coast of Wales. And I really hope I've pronounced that right. Hwanfor. It may be completely wrong. If it is, again, I'm sorry. John's grandfather had been a Methodist preacher. His father, Thomas, was also a Methodist preacher. And his younger brother, Evan Evans.
Oh, God.
A ridiculous name to give your child. Evan Evans. He would go on to become a Methodist preacher as well. There was a definite family business in the Evans household. You know, the males knew what they were going to be going to do.
Yeah.
But John, he was a little bit more impulsive than the rest of the family, with a streak of romanticism and wanderlust, which is probably why, in hindsight, it was not a good idea for his father to have trusted his education to a poet.
Which poet?
Ah, it's not someone I've heard of, but his name was Dafydd Thu Eryri. Sorry, I'll try that again. Dafydd Thu Eryri, which apparently means Black David of Snowdonia.
Excellent.
Because Thu is black, definitely that, and Eryri is the original name for Snowdonia. That's the native Welsh. Now, David had won an award for his epic poem on the subject of Madoc, and he told John stories of the Welsh intellectuals who had set up in London to argue the case for Welsh separatism, and how, actually, you know, when they won their cause, they were going to find a place for themselves over in America. You know, probably sharing the land with the Welsh-speaking tribes who would welcome their countrymen with open arms, and that then they could finally live in freedom from the English, who were annoying and always getting in the way. John accompanied David to an Eteisfod, which is a sort of a meeting, but it literally means sitting down, in 1790, at the age of 20, where he was first able to meet some of the most important Welsh cultural figures of the day.
I should probably mention, out of my very limited knowledge of pronouncing Welsh,
yes,
that the two D's is a TH sound, if that helps in your...
Yeah, so it's Thu, yeah. Thu. Fantastic.
Yeah. That's the only one I remember.
The only thing I know is that a microwave is called a poppity-ping, which is glorious. And I like to think that they knew what they were doing when they gave it that name. So let's have a bit of fun with it.
Yeah. I know some Scots Gaelic, and they have words for, like, texting and email that just, it just sounds like you actually made a word for it instead of just going, calling it like email like everyone else.
Mm.
I don't remember what the word is, but it's like a description thing. And I was like, okay. So, but that's not Gaelic. That's Gaelic. That's not Welsh.
We actually get Welsh language television. I can get, and sometimes if I want to watch, say, one of the Welsh football clubs or the Welsh national team play, I have to watch it in Welsh language. And it is very odd because the occasional word gets thrown in that obviously there's no Welsh equivalent, so it comes in English.
Yeah.
You're just trying to follow. It's impossible to follow, but it's very melodic. It's very nice to listen to. It's quite comforting.
Then you watch, like, the Six Nations rugby, and they're doing the Welsh national anthem. And I'm going, wait, every single member of this team is actually Welsh? And they go, they have to be. Like, that's amazing. Because I'm not Welsh. I'm glad they all know the Welsh national anthem. I love Wales. So, sorry. If I sound like I'm being weird. Pedantic.
Nothing wrong with loving Wales. It's a lovely place to be.
Yes. I was on the train through that really long town name that apparently is a Victorian name for tourism. But I was there for like 10 seconds.
Clanfair PGG.
The big long one. The big long one.
Clanfair PG is how everyone just shortens it because, yes, it is a ridiculously long name.
Yeah.
Welsh cultural figures, though.
Yes.
This included a man called Iolo Morganwg, who was calling for the Americans, in honour of Madoc's legacy, to provide the Welsh with an area of land so that they could all en masse move there and break free of, you know, British rule, of English rule even. Iolo's speech was an inspiration to young John Evans, who decided on the spot that he needed to move to London so that he could be at the heart of this new and exciting Welsh movement. Fortunately, his father had just died, so he didn't need to worry about disappointing his dad by not following him into the family business. John had no money, so he had to walk all the way to London from the west coast of Wales, which at best would have taken over a week.
Oh, God.
Yeah, and he at some point had to walk through Snowdonia National Park. So it took him, you know, the better part of a week, 2 weeks. And when he arrived, he was technically homeless. So he just made himself homeless and walked into one of the biggest cities in the world at the time. However, despite being homeless and having to, you know, beg for food, he began attending Welsh speaking meetings and was soon accepted as one of the guys. He was supported to find work and was even at times able to afford the luxury of a roof over his head.
Yay!
Yeah, just occasionally, you know, for special occasions. If it was his birthday, I think they'd all chip in and go, come on, you can stay on my sofa tonight, John. It's all right.
Yay!
A new book on Madoc was released the next year, called An Inquiry into the Truth of the Tradition Concerning the Discovery of America by Prince Madoc around the year 1170, by a man called John Williams. And I do love the fact that books, sort of pre-20th century, the titles gave a lot more away.
Mm-hmm.
There was no mystery in the title of, like, a Georgian book.
No.
You'd have the full plot synopsis if it was fiction, and if it was a non-fiction book, pretty much all the chapter headings would be right there in the title.
Yeah, I think Johnson's dictionary has like a really long title as well.
Oh, the original one. I should imagine.
Yeah,
so.
I think it's something like the English dictionary. I forgot what it is. Some really long nonsense thing. It's obviously a dictionary.
Mm. But then,
and he still forgot words. But that's life.
I mean, he forgot some words. I do like the Blackadder episode where they point out
that. Yeah, and if you go to the, if you look at his dictionary, he doesn't have those words.
He doesn't have.
There's no sauce. Or a sausage.
He doesn't. How does a man living in London not have the word sausage?
I know. I mean, aardvark, I understand. Mm. But sausage. Like, I went to his house, and I went both his houses, the one in London and the one in Lichfield, and they have a copy of the dictionary in there to look at. So, of course, the first words I look up are the naughty ones. And then,
yeah, obviously.
And then I look up sausage, I know. And then I look up sausage, and it's not there. And I'm going, these guys are geniuses. They found the one word that should be in here. And then I look at aardvark, and I go, I don't care anymore. We've already, you know.
Yeah. Once you've looked up the rude words and seen if he's put them in or not, you've done your work for the day.
Oh, yeah. No, it's Johnson's dictionary is amazing. If anyone wants to, there's an online version where you can look up all the words. So you don't have to actually travel to his houses, although it's fun to do so anyway.
Yeah, you get a lot more out of the trip. But if you've got to look up a word and you want to know how it was being described in the Georgian era, specifically by Dr. Samuel Johnson, you can do that online now. Because the internet's a wonderful thing.
And it hyperlinks to the poets he quotes from. So if you don't know the poet, you can go, oh, I learned something new today.
That sounds like it could become quickly sort of like an internet hole where 7 hours later you're reading some obscure Georgian poet's entire back catalogue.
I mean, if you care like that. I mean, Robert South was quoted and nobody knows who that is today.
I'm sorry, no. Sorry, Robert.
No. Yeah. He's buried in Westminster Abbey. That's all you need to know.
Oh, so he is one of the poets. He's in Poets' Corner.
Yeah, yeah, he is. He was a religious poet. And then, Johnson quotes him a few times in some of his words. Mm. So, yeah, they all kind of, like, mesh together. So, anyway, sorry, you're doing a thing.
There's no space for any more poets in Poets' Corner, I imagine.
There's a little bit of space, but not a lot. I think Weber has room there. I think he's earned his space there.
I was going to say, for me, it's Pam Ayres. She is truly the nation's poet. If you've never...
Yeah, but Weber literally is like everyone's heard of Weber. And I think he's earned his place when he wrote a song for the coronation.
Andrew Lloyd Webber?
Yes. Sir Andrew Lloyd Webber of the Cats fame. Yes.
No,
And Phantom of the Opera. He's Starlight Express.
he, for tax reasons, isn't a UK citizen. So I think, you know, he's made his decision.
There are non-UK citizens that are buried in Westminster Abbey.
I know, but I just don't want Andrew Lloyd Webber. Have you seen that man's face? No offense, but it's haunting.
I have.
It is.
He doesn't have to get a memorial. He can just be buried. I know, but he can just be buried in the floor and just have no face.
Okay. We'll have to rehash the argument when he dies. I don't think he'd appreciate us kind of deciding where we're going to put his remains at this moment. Bless him. Anyway, in a fit of bravado, Iolo announced that he wanted some able-bodied assistants to join him in a quest to find the Welsh-speaking tribe of natives in America in order to prove the truth of the story and to claim land on behalf of the Welsh nation. So this new book comes out and he's like, look, people are starting to say that they've seen this tribe. They definitely exist. And if we can find them and prove it, our claims to part of America are so solid. Let's do it, boys. Come on, who's with me? Iolo, who I definitely have to cover in a full episode later because he was an amazing man. He collected all Welsh sort of scraps of Welsh folklore and writing, and where bits didn't exist, he just forged them so that they did. He created his own new version of druidic practice and pretended it was ancient and got a load of people to become fake druids just by sheer personality. Spent a lot of his life in debtor's prison as well, because it turned out all of these things that he did and didn't actually generate a lot of money, but he was definitely a great speaker. However, because he was known to be a bit of a liar and liable to exaggeration, only one person agreed to go on his expedition with him. And that person was 21-year-old John Evans.
Yes.
Naturally, Iolo soon remembered that he actually had a wife and kids, and he had to provide for them. And he couldn't just go swanning off to America for an expedition of unknown time. So he quietly dropped the idea of leading this trip, this quest over to the other side of the world to search for some guys. However, John, he was still determined to go. The idea had really captured him, and he thought this was the perfect way for him to have an adventure while he was still young, and hopefully to become a national hero. He convinced Iolo to write a letter of introduction for him to a Welsh Baptist preacher called Dr. Jones. Sadly, first name not Indiana, he was a Samuel Jones, but he was living in Philadelphia at the time.
I was more sad he was Baptist and not Methodist.
Well,
because everyone else was Methodist, and you're like, Baptist preacher.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing, it's a different world. I mean, they're both sort of Protestant religions, as far as I understand.
They're nonconformist.
They're nonconformist.
For another day. For another day, I'll tell you more.
Oh, I've tried.
This is not the episode for explaining.
It would be great if someone could sit me down and go, here are all the different nonconformist denominations, and these are the specific ways in which they differ from each other.
I can do that for you, but not on this podcast.
Fair enough. I will hold you to that. Is it like a 7-hour lecture series that I'm going to have to sit down? Will there be homework?
No, I can. No, unless you want homework. No, it's just different ways of how they preach, really.
Ah, fair enough.
Yeah.
Well, he now had a hookup with a Baptist preacher in Philadelphia, so John borrowed the money for a transatlantic ticket in steerage, which I've been told is about as cheap as it gets. You're basically...
And it's terrible.
Yeah, your luggage at that point.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, no, it's, and I never ever want to go to steerage in real life. This boat is still in the harbor. This is going to Australia, and I'm not dealing with this in real life. I'm doing second class or better. Yeah. It's not happening.
I'll save up the extra. I mean, beggars can't be choosers. And someone said, right, what's the cheapest ticket you can get?
Well, yeah.
I'll give you that money, John. Off you go. But I'm not springing for, you know, you're not getting your half board. You're not getting full board. It's just you.
Yeah.
It was,
well, I gave you some food because you're on a boat, so you got something.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, just enough so that he didn't die, because that is just an inconvenience for everyone on board. Yeah. But it was a 7-week voyage in steerage that he had to go through. And apparently a rough 7 weeks. The Atlantic was not playing nicely during those 7 weeks.
It's terrible to cross the Atlantic, no matter when you do it. It's almost as bad as crossing the Channel.
Oh, we went across the Channel in last summer. It was grand. It was Mill Pond Flat. Beautiful. You could look one way and see the White Cliffs, look the other way and see the coast of France. It was wonderful.
But it can be terrible.
Oh, yeah. There are so many wrecks. My dad's recently got into sea kayaking, so canoeing around the coast, and he's bought himself a load of nautical charts, you know, like proper nautical maps. And they just have, there's just hundreds of wrecks dotted, because he goes down in Cornwall quite a lot, and just around that sort of southern tip of Britain, there's just wreck. I'm like,
and how many sea monsters are there on the maps?
Do you know what? Disappointingly, they hadn't sketched a single sea monster in the corner. I thought, just for posterity, you could, you know, keep up with the classics. Pretend there's like a serpent that's over that way. We'll all play along.
Like in the pirate movie where they draw a sea monster and they go, no, that's for just illustration purposes. And they find out there really is a sea monster.
Is that Pirates versus Scientists?
No, the pirate movie. Yes. Yeah, Pirates versus Scientists.
It had a different name in America, didn't it?
It's called The Pirate Movie.
Yeah. In Britain, it was called Pirates versus Scientists.
Oh, but that's weird that we call it that because Darwin actually joins the pirates.
Yeah. And I do, again, for historical sort of, you know, those little facts that are true, that bit where he's writing in his diary that he's depressed and everybody hates him.
Yeah, that is true.
Yeah, he did that all the time in his diary, just like, and everyone's just annoying me and I'm terribly lonely and I don't like this anymore. And then he'd go on to describe some other wonder that he just found in the Galapagos.
And to be fair, nobody liked it. You know, he didn't like anybody either. Like, it was both ways.
Yeah, yeah.
He's like, why are people not letting me do my job? Like, your job is to just be on the boat. We just need a scientist on the boat. You don't have to do anything. Why do you want to leave the boat? Oh, God, Darwin.
He just wanted to be useful. Bless him.
Yes, he is now. And but he called his the Queen's dad a chimp, and they were not amused.
It wouldn't be.
No, that's a shout-out to a song in a band that maybe people have heard of, but if not, I'll...
People can let me know.
Yes, people can let you know if they know what I'm referring to.
But during this entire segue, John's been on a boat, just puking his guts up, I imagine. He arrived in Baltimore on October the 10th, 1792, with only a few coins to his name, the clothes on his back, and his letter of introduction. With no other means at his disposal, John asked which direction Philadelphia was in, and walked the 100 miles or so in order to introduce himself to Dr. Jones and to seek help in finding the Welsh-speaking tribe. So it's a bit of a rough start to this expedition. I'm going to have to walk all the way to Philadelphia, but once I get there, amongst my Welsh-speaking brethren, I'm sure people will help me with supplies, they'll help me with maps, they'll help me with everything I need, and they'll send me off ready to go on my grand adventure.
And to be fair, walking from Baltimore to Philadelphia is a lot easier than walking from West Wales to London.
Yeah, he was used to walking, I think. I don't think Evans ever had the money for a coach. I think it was all...
No, but the distance is also smaller, too.
Yeah, I think the first one was about 300 miles. So this he would have got done in maybe three, four days.
Maybe a week.
If he was taking the scenic route. And to be honest, there was a lot for him to see. This was a brand new continent for him. Yeah. He'd probably stop in every 2 minutes and go, what the hell's that? And just stop and passes by.
Yeah, that's how I am in England too. Ooh, what's that? And then suddenly everyone's going like, why did you stop? I'm like, I've never seen this before. And everyone else is going, this is here everywhere. Yes, we understand Whitehall's white. I'm like, but it's so white, Whitehall.
Mm.
Like, it's clean. Like, you're just totally showing off how grand you are and you don't notice.
Yeah. It's weird what you can get used to. Where I used to work every day, driving into Lancaster, I had to drive past a castle, like a big, imposing castle. And I'd sometimes have to remind myself, this is amazing. I'm driving past a castle that was first, the foundations were laid in Roman times. And it's just one of the things I pass on my way to work.
Yes, because I go to castles all the time and I go, I want to see this castle. Oh, it's down the road from my house. Mm. Really? I don't live, my castle's White Castle. It's a food restaurant. It's not even a real castle. It just makes little square burgers. It doesn't mean, what? Yeah.
Yeah, I've never understood the square burger thing, but,
It's, how they got famous.
Yeah, really. You've got to have your USP, haven't you? You've got to have your selling points.
Yep. They were the first people to invent sliders.
Really?
Now sliders. I think so. I may be wrong on this one. But that's the little square mini burgers are like sliders now.
Yeah. Well,
so I'm going to make a guess that they started that. But White I could be
Castle
totally
has
wrong.
Now become the best castle in the world based on that. Sliders are amazing. What an idea.
Like this mini burger. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I kind of live near a White Castle, but that's not a real castle.
Now, Dr. Jones, he read the letter and he listened to John's request for help in his one-man expedition. He then politely suggested to the young man that his plan was a little bit insane. Regardless of the lack of preparation and the distance, the route that John was proposing covered a number of active war zones on the frontier between the native peoples, who were being supported by the British, the Americans, and the Spanish. So there was like a three-way battle for territory going on, and John's plan was to just walk directly through that. And hope okay. that everyone just went, oh, don't worry, he's Welsh. He doesn't have a side. He's let's just live and let live with this one particular man.
This actually probably is not as dangerous as it sounds.
Because
we had all the people going to California as well, and they had to go through all that territory too. So
this was pre the Californians. This is
but it's 1792.
Yeah,
and it's before the War of 1812, and all the English are dealing with Napoleon, or will be dealing with Napoleon very shortly. Yeah. So they're still at war over there. So I mean, it's still probably not too bad if he just doesn't screw around and just goes and does his thing. He should be okay.
Yes, if he doesn't screw around. Let's see. Seeing that John would not be dissuaded, Dr. Jones decided to provide some tough love to his fellow countrymen and refused to provide him with any support, suggesting quite firmly that he return to Baltimore and get a return ticket on the next available ship. He was like, you know, I will give you money specifically for a boat ride home. That's all I'm going to give you. And if you're not willing to take that, then I have nothing for you. John did return to Baltimore, another 100 miles walking. But instead of getting on a ship, he got himself a job as an apprentice surveyor, figuring that if he was going to go into uncharted territory, which he still definitely was, regardless of what anyone said, it would probably be useful if he could draw his own map. Because the area that he wanted to get to hadn't been mapped by this point. People kind of vaguely knew where it was, but he was going to have to make it up on the fly if he was going to go there. He printed some pamphlets to try and drum up some donations from the Welsh communities. And was
you just love these pamphlet people. Everybody do has pamphlets.
The Georgian era was the time of the pamphlet. The solution to every problem was to print a pamphlet. I swear.
It's like every podcast. It's like I'm a pamphlet. Read my pamphlet.
I'd love to mock them more, but you know, we're in the modern era of that, which is every bugger has a podcast. So I can't really say anything. If I was in Georgian England, I would have been the person throwing pamphlets out for absolutely no reason.
As long as you didn't kill the Prime Minister, that's fine.
Well, he didn't read the pamphlet. If he'd have read the pamphlet, he'd have been fine. Spencer knew what he'd done wrong. In those last moments of life, I'm sure.
Oh dear, I've been shot.
But he is making some good points in this pamphlet that I'm using to stem the blood.
Oh God. Okay, sorry. I'm sorry. Sorry, death is not funny.
No.
It's not funny at all. No. The good news is I'm literally promoting like all of your other episodes at the same time. Yep. So anyone who's only heard this one can literally go back and listen to these other ones, because this is why this is an amazing podcast.
You're great at this advertising stuff. I'm terrible at self-advertising, so I need other people to do it for me. I need to bring people in who are able to sell themselves.
I try. Anyway, go on.
You'd be sad to know the pamphlets didn't work.
Oh, well, of course not. It's America. I don't want to read.
After a few months, he gave up on that idea. He quit his surveying job, and he walked back to Philly to see Dr. Jones again. So that's 300 miles he's walked so far, and he's not really started his expedition yet. He hoped that his persistence would convince the doctor that he would be able to complete the mission and thus was deserving of support. He's like, maybe it was just a test. And Dr. Jones sends away every young man at first, waiting to see if they'll come back. And only if you come back do you pass the test.
Fair play. Fair play. Doesn't work, right?
No, he refused again. And this time, because he was really worried about Evans, to be fair to him, he invited a string of influential local Philadelphians to come to his house and to try and dissuade John from going. So he's getting...
That's what you have to do, an intervention!
It was like a proper... He was, but like, you know, the mayor of Philadelphia is like, can you just come to this house and to my house and tell this young man that his plan is madness, please? He may listen to you. You are literally, you know, the mayor. But Evans, no one was going to convince him otherwise.
is a determined person right there.
You know, they tried pointing out the practical side of things, that, you know, raids were occurring regularly just west of Pennsylvania at this point. As far as he could hope to get without the risk of some kind of injury or death was, well, you can get to Pennsylvania, which is just over there. Any further
You're in Pennsylvania, because Philadelphia is in Pennsylvania.
Yes, it is. Damn it. I'm thinking of Pittsburgh.
Pittsburgh is also in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, so just west of Pittsburgh.
Yes, okay.
As you can tell, my geography of America is still developing.
My geography of the UK is still developing. So I literally didn't know where you lived for a while. When you said Morecambe Bay, I'm like, I don't know where that is. And you go, Lancashire. And I actually had to ask somebody else where Lancashire was. I'm going, yeah, no, other side of the country, not going to be over there. Nope, okay, fine.
It's quite small, Lancashire, to be fair, on a map. We're not as big as Yorkshire next door. But
I haven't been to it, so...
But they told John, you know, you will get killed. And he responded just by saying, don't worry, God will be my shield. Everything will work out for me. Which I kind of understand, because at this point he's, what, 21, 22? You're not going to die when you're 21, 22. You don't have that idea of mortality yet that comes with being a little bit older. So,
like 37.
Yeah, I mean, it's fair play, isn't it, to the youth. Like, yeah, no. Everything will work out fine.
Even 30, you're still fearless. You're like, no, I haven't died yet, so I'll still be alive.
Yeah.
And then you get older, and you're like, you know, I'm amazed I haven't died by now.
Yeah.
I should have died 15 times. I'm like, that wasn't safe. How did I get away with that?
Because you didn't know it wasn't safe, so you weren't nervous, is generally. Yeah. You're too young and inexperienced to know that you should die, so you don't. And John's still in that kind of area. He's in that region of his life still. So in March of 1793, with only $1.75 to his name, John Evans headed out past both Lancaster and York and into the... And I'm going to ask you, is it the Allegheny Mountains? Or is it the...
Allegheny.
Allegheny Mountains. There we go.
Allegheny Mountains. Oh, wait, was he in... Oh, Lancaster and York. I know where that is.
Yeah, yeah.
I have a friend who lives in that area.
Fantastic.
He lives in Lancaster. I call that... It's the Roar of the Roses. I call it the War of the Roses, Pennsylvania.
Yeah, and that's what... It just struck me. It's like, you know, walking out past Lancaster and York, as you do, off into the mountains.
And he also likes John Dee, so now he gets called out twice in the same podcast.
Oh, wow.
And I won't tell you his name. Yeah, I won't tell you his name, but I'm going to make him listen to this now.
So that he can see that we're just making content specifically for him.
Oh, yeah, totally. He plays Warhammer too, by the way.
Oh, good. Well, we'll see if we can drop in some references as well. It's going to be difficult with this particular story, but we could try.
Yeah.
For 2 weeks, John walked through the mountains towards Fort Pitt, which apparently it was in the centre of Pittsburgh. Or what is now Pittsburgh. On the convoluted, you know, where it becomes the Ohio River, the two rivers become the Ohio River. So when I was looking for this, I was just like, oh, it's Heinz Stadium. It's where the Pittsburgh Steelers play. That was where Fort Pitt was.
Oh, yes. Do you want to hear a fun fact about Pittsburgh that may or may not be relevant to this podcast?
Of course.
Pittsburgh is named after William Pitt the Elder.
The Elder, not the Younger.
Yes, because the Elder is the one who supported the independence of America to his dying breath. And this is a literal dying breath. Like, his last speech in Parliament was about promoting the revolution in America, and that he died. But not in Parliament. I think it was a little bit after. But literally, he was pretty much dying. And the actual Blackfriars Bridge was supposed to be named after him as the William Pitt Bridge. But since, you know, the English were all like, no, we don't want the colonies to become independent, they renamed it to the more wokely appropriate Blackfriars Bridge.
Mm.
Because obviously, you know, we have to be diverse.
Yes.
So they call it the Blackfriars Bridge.
But I did not know that. It was named after William Pitt the Elder.
The Elder, yes. Because William Pitt the Elder was a big follower of that. And so there's like William Pitt statues that were all over the colonies that the English came in and like destroyed them. So,
wow.
And I've seen two that are left. There's like been a few more, but I've seen two. And they're like missing arms and heads and other body parts. But yeah.
But they're still there. They endure.
Well, one's in a museum and one's in like a courthouse building that I had to get permission to go into to see it. Wow. And I made some excuse. Yeah. Fun stories. But yes, fun facts about William Pitt the Elder. for you.
I feel bad for my, because I got into the NFL sort of sight unseen, and I picked a team and I picked Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
There's just over time you just get this idea of anyone else in the conference. You just have this irrational hatred for them. Just
well, I mean, at least we don't.
So often.
But we don't kill each other when go to an opposing team's games like you guys do. You literally have to be segregated, or you literally will kill each other.
Yes, that does happen occasionally, but
and I don't know why.
It's something to do. I mean, I don't. I always sit in the family stand when I go to Blackburn. And, you know, I've never been a victim of or been a perpetrator of football violence. But, yes, I have seen it.
Yeah.
And I have sort of like, you know, there have been times when it's been like, right, we need to get out of here now because it's taken a turn. And I don't want to be here when the first punch is thrown because, yeah, then you're just
a target. I've even had commentary from people like, going to an away game going, no, we do want to walk the mile from the train station because we cannot sit next to them because they live here. So it was like, you guys are mental. You're walking a mile to the... Okay, whatever. I don't understand you at all. Just go play your games.
When in Pittsburgh, he managed to find a lovely man called Mr. Wheeler, who allowed him to stay for a month while he waited for the Ohio River to rise up enough so that he could take a boat towards Limestone, Kentucky.
Excellent.
From there, he headed north to Cincinnati, where he again found a person willing to provide lodgings. However, this time it was a man called Brigadier General James Wilkinson, who was actually a Spanish double agent. So he was a general in the US Army, but he was actually working for the Spanish.
That was the Spanish-American War, so yeah, it makes sense.
General Wilkinson suggested to John that he would fare much better if he were to sail down the Mississippi to the Spanish town of New Madrid on the western side. Because like all of Louisiana and a huge swathe of America were under Spanish control, but the Mississippi kind of marked that boundary for a long time.
Yes. Well done, you knew that.
Yeah, I learnt it in a book. I didn't know it before this week, I have to say.
Yeah.
In order to be accepted on the western bank of the Mississippi, John had to swear an oath to the King of Spain and legally changed his name officially to Don Juan Evans to show that he was super serious in his new allegiance.
Wow, God. Okay.
It was fantastic. You need to take on a Spanish name. Okay. Juan? It's as close as I can get to John. Because I really... kind of happy with my name. It appeared that this switch of allegiance didn't sit well with John, as within a week he had developed malaria and may have died if it had not been for another Welsh family who decided to take him in and nurse him back to health. The Rees family.
You did all the three words. You just cut all the three words now.
Yeah, we've had adventure, we've had river, and now we've had his first illness.
Hooray!
Foreshadowing. But yes, he sort of got to New Madrid, a Spanish settlement, developed malaria, and just so happened to bump into a Welsh family who were like, oh, you're a local boy. Right, no worries. Come and stay with us. We'll nurse you back to health. We'll make sure that you don't die. The Rees family. It took 2 months for John to recover, but eventually he felt he was recovered enough for another 2,000-mile slog through war zone and swampland in order to find the Welsh-speaking tribe. He started towards St. Louis, but within a day he had lost the path and was left stumbling through the wilderness.
St. Louis.
Is it St. Louis?
St. Louis.
Ah, oh, I got that wrong. Okay, we'll do it again.
I think either or is probably okay. I'm not sure, but St. Louis is, you know, they tend to pronounce the S.
Fair enough. I don't want to make the people of St. Louis get annoyed at me.
I don't think they will, but I could be wrong too, so they could be mad at me.
Looking through, we definitely had a St. Louis listener last month, so I don't want to, sort of alienate my one St. Louis. So
if I'm wrong too, I'm American and I have not been there. So if I mispronounced it, my bad.
Well, we'll try it both ways. So he started towards St. Louis, but within a day he had lost the path and was left stumbling alone through the wilderness. After a week of this, his clothes and shoes had been destroyed and he was walking virtually naked under the unforgiving summer sun, still really suffering from the after effects of malaria. When I say he'd recovered, he hadn't recovered to the point where you'd want to be doing something like this. At one point he reportedly went blind as well.
Stop looking into the sun.
But how else will you know which way to go? It rises in the east, it sets in the west. I need to go west. So as the sun's starting to go down, I need to stare directly at it in order to make sure I'm not going the wrong way. But he did end up going the wrong way, because he ended up back on the American side of the Mississippi River somehow. And he would likely have died if it wasn't for the fact that he was insanely lucky. Because as he wandered, naked and delirious, he just so happened to be found by yet another Welsh family. And again, they decided, against their best interests, to nurse him back to health at their own expense.
Oh, God.
And they may have regretted this decision, as John...
There's a lot of Welsh people.
Yeah, it's amazing how many Welsh people there were. Either that, or there were only, like, 10 Welsh families in the entirety of America, and John Evans just so happened to bump into each and every one of them during his journey. Which I wouldn't put it past him. He seems like he's got that kind of insane look.
Yeah.
But yeah, they said, yeah, we'll help you get back on your feet. He stayed with them for a year and a half.
Oh, wow.
You know, that house guest who will never leave.
Did he make pamphlets?
I think he was just living a life of leisure. He was getting fed 3 squares a day, and he was just living his life, going, well, maybe I don't need to do any more. This seems like a pretty nice setup. Now, he had been doing other things. He found the time to become a Freemason.
Good.
And he'd started actually talking to the locals and trying to learn something about what the rest of his journey might entail. So when fur traders came through, local government officials who would, you know, be knowing about strategies and where places were going to be sort of linked up next, he tried to get as much intel as he could over that year and a half. So for the first time, really, you know, he's a couple of hundred miles into his journey. This was the first time at which he felt, maybe I need to do some preparation for the journey. Which is better late than never, I guess. But maybe if he'd started planning when he was in Philadelphia, he might not have developed malaria. He might have taken some steps to prevent that. But he's learning as he goes. You've got to give him credit for that, at least. He's not stumbling blindly onwards.
All the time.
Yeah, he went blind, he recovered, but then he had a recurrence of the blindness. Which is... Yeah. It's weird because it doesn't come up again after this. So obviously he got better from blindness. I was a little bit blind, but it got better, which is lucky for him. Because, I mean, doing this trip was pretty hardcore anyway, but doing it while completely blind would have been probably even beyond John Evans.
Yeah.
In December of 1794, after spending a year and a half with this poor Welsh family, John heard about a planned 3-year Spanish expedition into the Missouri Basin. He decided that this was probably the best opportunity to explore further west with people who actually knew what they were doing and who had the money for supplies. So he's just like, I'll tag along with the Spanish. You know, I've already been accepted because they know me as Don Juan Evans, so I'm sure they'll be fine with the fact that I disappeared for a year and a half and then turned up from the American side of the Mississippi to say that I want to be on the top secret expedition with no ulterior motive. John made the decision to travel to French-speaking, Spanish-controlled St. Louis, to sign up for the expedition. He was warned against it by his new friends, as the city was currently on high alert due to attacks from American forces led by General George Rogers Clark, who was actually working for the French at the time despite being a US general, because... apparently, it was just a mess at this point in history.
Oh, yeah, no. Yeah, it was. It was totally a mess. I agree, yes.
Everything was up in the air, and no one knew who was going to come out on top.
That's right. You want to be on the winning side all the time.
Yeah. That is to say, it was a confusing and terrifying time for the residents of St. Louis. And when John Evans arrived, all alone, unable to speak either French or Spanish, and tried to explain that he wanted to tag along with the Spanish expedition in the hopes that he might find signs of a Welsh-speaking tribe of Native Americans, they naturally assume that he was a spy, which I say is fair.
It is fair, yeah.
Just to be safe, they loaded him with irons and put him in the stocks in the middle of winter and left him
there. The stocks are the pillory. The stocks are the pillory.
The stocks.
They're with the feet.
Yes. The stocks are the ones with the...
Okay.
Yeah.
With the feet, and the pillory is the one with the hands.
Yeah.
So they... We're just making sure.
They just left him exposed to the winter for a week or two to make sure that he was super serious about... You know, he was going to stick to that story of searching for a Welsh-speaking tribe. It was weirdly the winter that eventually saved his life, because he was probably going to die of exposure. But because it was so cold, the Mississippi had frozen over, and the mayor of the town he'd been staying in prior on the American side, He heard about the situation and was able to walk across the frozen river to inform the authorities that John Evans was not a spy. What he was saying was completely genuine in terms of his reason for wanting to go with them. He was just young and stupid. I know you think that he's nefarious. He's not. He's an idiot. But he is a well-intentioned idiot. So please, you know, don't kill him. I mean, you don't have to help him. We weren't going to help him, but please don't kill him. He's quite nice, really. He's quite a personable guy. Once the story was related to them in French, the romance of John's quest convinced the authorities to release him. And he suddenly found himself invited to all the best parties as a bit of a curiosity. At one of these parties, he met another man with Welsh heritage called Jacques Clamorgan, which is a weird mix of French and Welsh. Jacques Clamorgan, who just so happened to be one of the main people organising the Spanish expedition. John was able to convince him that it might be important to have a native Welsh speaker in the party in case they did find the Madoc tribe on their journey up the Missouri River. So he's like, I might not come in handy, but if this tribe exists, I would be the only person who would be able to converse with them, and you would have one up on the British, you'd have one up on everybody else who might want to try and seek support from this particular, tribe. I'm trying to think of the right word then.
Yeah, tribe is fine.
In fact, he made his case so convincingly, did John, he was employed as the assistant of the expedition's leader, who naturally was a Scotsman called James Mackay, making him ostensibly second in command of the entire thing. So if Mackay went down, Evans would suddenly be promoted to, yeah, you've got to organise the expedition now. Mm. Which is amazing, to go from being in the stocks and probably going to die of exposure within 2 weeks. Oh, you're actually going to help lead the expedition.
Insanely lucky he is.
Yeah. They set out on September the 1st, 1795, with Evans commanding his own boat of 30 men. Now, things apparently started well. The expedition covered around 15 miles each day, meaning that they were making their way up the river quicker than the Lewis and Clark expedition would do a decade later. And Mackay was able to secure permission from the Othacheta tribe to travel through their lands without too much fuss, because that was the other thing. I didn't know this, but apparently, although land, you couldn't own land in terms of, you know, Native Americans, indigenous peoples didn't own land, they were very territorial over the rivers and who could use the rivers. Yes. So that was where the sticking point always came. If you wanted to use the river as sort of like a highway, you had to get permission of whoever controlled the local territory.
That's true.
I did not realise that. So that was another thing I learnt in this story.
Yep.
When they reached the territory of the Omaha tribe, it was full winter, and the expedition had to hope that Chief Blackbird would be happy to provide them with hospitality, or they would have been forced to turn back. Which strikes me as a very odd thing, because if you're setting off in September, how are you surprised by winter coming? I mean, you're not hoping to travel 2,000 miles in, you know, a month and a half, are you?
Have you played Oregon Trail? Because that will answer your question.
Oh, I've played Oregon Trail, and I know the story of the Donner Party very well.
So. Not even the Donner Party. That's if you played just Oregon Trail by itself.
Yeah, of course. Hasn't everyone? It's fantastic.
Right, and that's how you know. Go, no, we'll just do the latest we can go. We'll be fine. You've died of dysentery.
Yeah.
It's very obvious to not do this.
What is it? You've got to be by Monument Rock in something like June. Or you're already screwed yourself.
Yes. Mm. Yes. Well, the Donner Party was its own bunch of nonsense. That's a different thing. They left on time. Just the people didn't know where they were going. And that's what happened.
No, it was a shortcut. It's fine. It's fine.
The shortcut.
Why do what everyone else who's going to survive is doing? We'll take the shortcut. Yeah. For no reason. It's like, what is the benefit of getting there a few weeks earlier? Honestly.
Every time that happens, something goes wrong. Mm. Titanic, 1912. We'll just get there faster. No, just don't go faster. Take your time.
Do it right.
Okay.
The people with you want to get there.
And not die.
Yeah, a couple of years from now, they're not going to be complaining that it took 2 weeks longer than it had to. They will have forgotten that. But if they're dead, they don't have the opportunity to forget that. Come on, guys.
And then you get jokes about cannibalism. So is it worth it to you? Maybe, I don't know.
I've always said if I get into one of those situations, I wouldn't be standing on ceremony. As soon as the first person died, I would be prepping the meat and trying to store it. Just in case.
Yeah.
You know, not eating it until the other supplies have run out, but like, let's start making some jerky.
That's right. I mean, how dare you assume I wouldn't eat people?
Yeah. You know, like the alive thing, if I was stuck up on that mountain, I wouldn't be burying people with ceremony. I'd be like, right, I know it's really sad, but we've got to start prepping these bodies now.
Well, I'd bury them with ceremony in, like, the coldest part of the mountain, so they'd be frozen.
Oh, yeah, well, you're refrigerating them. That's fine, yeah. But I would not be getting rid of the bodies.
Well, no, but I would do a ceremony, be nice, and then go, your soul is now in heaven. I will now eat you.
Yeah, you've left this body. It is an empty vessel now. I don't feel as bad.
This may not be on the podcast. Too
I think the chances of having to eat somebody are very slim. I've just, you know, I've always been quite open with the fact that I would be up for it if it meant survival.
I've also even said that if I die, people are welcome to eat me as part of my final wishes.
It goes both ways. I wouldn't get offended if I was the person who died, if everybody left ate me. It's like, you got to do what you got to do in those situations.
But not even in like a survival situation. I've literally said, if I die and you want to turn my body into food, you can.
Oh, just like if you died in the middle of London. Like, don't take me to the mortuary. Take me to the local Five Guys and we will grind it up. Have fun.
Yes. Take me to Fleet Street. Find me Mrs. Lovett. Make me a pie. I'm told that is illegal to do. But if it was legal, you're more than welcome to.
Mm. If you can find a loophole some way.
There's got to be a loophole some way. Mm. Like if it's in my will.
I don't think you can induce people to commit crimes even in a will. I think that would be...
Yeah.
They'd still have committed a crime by eating a body because it's interfering with a corpse, isn't it? Would be the...
I don't know. Anyway, but it's something I've said people can do if they wanted to. Mm.
Well, luckily, the Evans, the expedition, it didn't come to that because Chief Blackbird was willing to help. And John Evans spent months with the tribe, learning their songs and sharing his own on a little tin whistle that apparently he carried with him. So he taught them sort of native Welsh songs.
Oh, nice.
He even got to go on a hunting trip when the food stocks were running low. So he was selected to go out with some of the hunters from the tribe to see how they did things. So he's getting a real sort of, crash course in how to try and survive out in the wilderness, especially in winter, which was bound to come in handy because it was going to be more than 1 year's trip, this. They were going to have to face another winter. So having a sort of a winter with some people who were very, very used to these conditions and knew exactly how to do it was really great education for the guys. So maybe
American winters are terrible, even today.
We can't complain over here. I mean, we do. It's just our way. But then you see videos from America and you're like, jeez, that is like feet and feet of snow.
None of you can complain. No. None of you. You can wear one jacket all year. We have to wear 12 jackets in one day.
Yeah. Yeah. This last winter, I didn't even get out my big coat once.
Right. Right. And so I don't even know what coat I have to wear when I leave the house. So I have to wear 12 coats. Let's figure it out.
Yeah. No, that's a problem. Thankfully, we don't have to deal with.
Exactly.
No. I'll count my blessings on that one.
Yes.
The stay with the Omaha tribe and the goodwill which built up proved vital in the ongoing success of the trip, as it was the Omaha who were able to negotiate with the Lakota tribes to the north to allow safe passage.
Because Lakota tribe?
Lakota, thank you.
Lakota.
Lakota You're tribes. Welcome. Because I didn't know, but the term Sioux was actually like an insult and was offensive, and there was no such tribe as the Sioux tribe.
Yeah, there's a bunch of that, because a lot of the tribe names are either like, we are like the one people or something tribe, and the other names are like the other people. And I don't know the difference. But like, that's what the names come from. Is there either the name of the tribe themselves is we're like the one tribe. Mm. And then the other names are just, they're just, yeah. It's either one.
I guess it depends who you asked. If you asked one tribe, they might sort of just as a joke say, oh, and those guys over there. And then just an insulting word. It's like, that's what they're called.
And that's what you think the name is.
Yeah. Cause you're just
like you're the prime minister. Well, yes, I am the prime minister. And that's how you get a prime minister. Same thing. You just own the epithet.
Yeah. Well, I did at least learn that it's not Sioux, it's Lakota. So
okay,
I'm trying not to offend anyone here.
There's at least you pronounce Sioux correctly. So good job.
Well, that's only because of Susie Sioux.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, from the Banshees.
Yeah, yeah. That's the only reason I know how to pronounce that.
Okay.
The eventual agreement was for a smaller party to be allowed to travel north, with Mackay remaining with the Omaha to make good on all the promises of compensation for the help that Chief Blackbird had provided. So he'd been making a hell of a lot of promises. It's like, oh, if you negotiate on our behalf, we'll bring you more stuff, we'll bring you more provisions, we'll make sure that all the best stuff's coming to you. And Chief Blackbird was smart enough to go, well, brilliant, but you don't get to leave until all of those things you've promised come here. You can send other people off, but we're keeping you as collateral, just in case, you know, it turned out you were lying. Because that was quite a common European tactic, was to promise the world to a tribe for their help, and then as soon as they saw a chance to just scoot off and leave them, it's like, no, sorry, those were lies, bye. Let's hope we don't run into you again. But we got what we wanted at that particular moment.
Yes.
But this meant that it was left to John Evans himself to lead the next stage of the journey, along with only two other companions. As he was now in uncharted territory, Evans used his skills as a surveyor to begin making his own maps of the area as he was travelling through. All in all, he made 7 panels of maps, which for a long time were thought to have been created by Lewis and Clark, but were actually used by them as part of their own expedition just over a decade later, after they had been gifted by President Jefferson himself.
Mm-hmm.
So these things that Evans was doing, he didn't know it at the time, but they were going to prove vital to finding a way to the Pacific.
Yes. Manifest destiny.
Now, this one you're going to have to help me with. Even when he was captured by the Arrakis tribe.
Arrakis?
Well, Arrakis is Dune, isn't it? I'm assuming that's where Frank Herbert got the name for, but I think it might be Arrakis.
I want to say Arrakis.
Fair enough. We'll go with Arrakis. Hopefully.
If anyone wants to correct that, you're welcome to.
Yeah. But even though he was captured, John saw an opportunity. He questioned his hosts regarding any tribes they knew of who might speak Welsh. And when representatives from other tribes were visiting, he made sure to gain as much information as he could about what lay ahead. So he was a prisoner, but he was a prisoner who was allowed to talk to everyone because he was a bit of a novelty. It's like, look at this white dude that we've got staying with us for an extended period of time. And he took full advantage. You know, are there any lighter skinned tribes over west somewhere or north of here? You know, he was asking, you know, in terms of the dialects, is there anything different about them? Is there anything that might suggest that one of these tribes might have some Welsh sort of heritage? He continued this sort of style of interrogation, despite him being the prisoner, for 6 weeks, until he was almost certain that the next tribe he was likely to encounter, the Mandans, were the most likely to be the lost tribe of Madoc. He was so excited by this news that he promised the Arrakis anything and everything in order to be allowed to continue his journey. So he felt he was so close. It's like, you want food, you want supplies, you want us to send you all the gold that Spain has. That's absolutely fine. I just need to carry on up the Missouri River a little bit further. I'll even come back. Just let me go and have a look and see if I can finally find this Welsh tribe. And finally, on September the 23rd, 1796, after 5 years, 2 periods of imprisonment, 2 serious illnesses, and over 3,000 miles of travel, mostly by foot, John Evans had made it to the Mandan tribe, who he believed were the descendants of Madoc. Unusually, the Mandans were a settled people who had a love of music and dancing. They also have a legend of a lone man who arrived in an ark-like canoe. This story must have been incredibly exciting for Evans, who would likely immediately have linked this to the legend of Madoc. It's like, and that they're telling me that a guy turned up in a canoe, the kind of which they'd never seen before, to, you know, teach them things that they had never known. This sounds exactly like what would happen if a European had just turned up randomly over nearly 1,000 years ago. But it soon became clear that there was no link between the Mandan language and Welsh.
Aww.
Even worse, Evans was now on the border with the British Canadian territories and found himself in a conflict which ended in an assassination attempt at the same time as the Spanish company backing the expedition lost their biggest backer to yellow fever. So he found himself right on the frontier. And it turned out that some of these British Canadian sort of traders had children who were, you know, born to the Mandan tribe. So they had familial links. And Evans was saying, no, I've claimed this for Spain now. These guys are going to be under Spanish sort of protectorate, so you can't come here anymore. And it started off, as most arguments between British people do, with letters being sent back and forth.
And pamphlets.
Yeah, and pamphlets detailing the rights and wrongs of each person's position, until eventually one of the traders just came to the village, went to the hut where Evans was staying, and just literally tried to shoot him in the face, which escalated things a little.
Mm-hmm.
But that wasn't the thing that kind of convinced him that it was all over. What convinced him was the fact that the guy who'd been putting up all the money and sending all the supplies out was suddenly dead, and the person who replaced him wasn't quite so keen to keep pumping money into this expedition because they weren't even close to getting to the Pacific by this stage. You know, they still had the Rockies to cover and it was still thousands of miles for them to go. And he was like, actually, we've not even secured the territory that we've got. Maybe we need to sort of think about making New Spain a bit more secure before we expand any further. So he was all for recalling all of these guys immediately.
Mm.
So if Evans did want to continue on to the Pacific, as was the original plan, he would have to do so with no further supplies or support. He did look for a reason to continue, asking the Mandans if there was any evidence of a whiter-skinned people using Welsh words who might live west of the Rockies or southwest in the desert. But they could give him no comfort, and he had to accept that his quest, the thing that he'd dedicated the last 6 years of his life to, had all been in vain. He'd been chasing a fantasy.
Aww.
So reluctantly, in May of 1797, John Evans began the long journey home. John Evans arrived back in St. Louis on July 15th, 1797. He wrote to Dr. Jones in Philadelphia to confirm that there was no Welsh tribe, nor had there ever been. His dream now broken, John Evans took a job as a surveyor until, in 1798... he was asked to move to New Orleans to live in the house of the governor, Gayoso de Lemos. When I say he was asked, he was kind of forced to live in the governor's house because the governor was concerned that Evans had knowledge of the interior of America, which could be very useful to the British if he decided to defect back to the other side. So he planned to keep Evans under a semi-formal house arrest for the foreseeable future. So it wasn't even that, you know, he hadn't managed to complete the thing that he wanted to do. It was the fact that what he had managed was now considered so dangerous that he was somebody who had to be watched closely and had to have a lot of limits put on his freedom. This constraint and this constant sort of being watched and observed, it was the last straw for Evans, who began coping by drinking heavily. He suffered a recurrence of his malaria. And knowing that he would never succeed in his goal, the malaria and the alcohol took their toll rapidly on his health. And in May of 1799, John Evans died in New Orleans at the age of only 29.
Older than Pocahontas.
Mm. Oh, yes, another who was taken very young. But all in all, he was only in America for 8 years.
Yeah.
And he got through all of that.
Yeah.
But while John Evans died, and because he wasn't a Catholic, he was buried in New Orleans Cemetery No. 1.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't bother marking the graves of people who weren't Catholics. So he's somewhere in that graveyard.
Okay.
No one will know where. There's a corner that was for sort of non-Catholic people that was, I think, dated from 1805, so it's a bit late, but apparently they'd started burying people there before they finished it because they needed to put the Protestants somewhere. And that was as good a spot as any. So he's probably mingled in with the bones of many other Baptists, Methodists, you know, nonconformist congregations of all stripes in a corner of this cemetery in New Orleans. But his notes and maps survived, and copies were passed across to the Americans, just as the Spanish governor of New Orleans had feared. The information that was contained on the geography, the tribes, and the best routes to take were all vital in the success of the Lewis and Clark expedition, with Evans' maps being incredibly accurate even when compared to modern-day examples. He was an amazing cartographer, it turned out. But it wasn't just that. He'd been asked to keep two journals by Mackay as he went off. One was to accurately describe how far they went, what the terrain was like, Worthy might sort of be able to make passage across rivers and ford rivers, all the sort of geographical stuff. But he was asked to keep a second notebook around where there were supplies of various foodstuffs, where you might be able to hunt successfully, you know, all the other bits, you know, where you might be able to resupply with good hardwood, where you might be able to find, you know, building materials. So he provided this really accurate and really detailed description of everything that someone would need to know to get to just east of the Rocky Mountains without too much hassle. And that is the story of a Welshman who went searching for a fictional tribe on the other side of the world and inadvertently made the Pacific expedition possible.
Hooray!
And the source for the story was a book called American Interior by a Welsh gentleman called Gruff Rhys, who is not only the singer for the Super Furry Animals, but is also a direct relative of Evans. So you can trace his family tree back to John Evans.
And the Rhys family, who took him in when he was blind and had malaria.
Yeah, possibly. It probably intermingled back in Wales. It's like, oh, well, you did our son. He's dead now, but you did him a service. So let's meet up. Let's stay in touch.
I did not know about him before. Good job. Mm.
Thank you. And even better, because I normally say the source is a book. Gruff Rhys, along with writing the book, he made a documentary about his journey following his ancestors' travels. But also there is a full album called American Interior that you can listen to, should you wish, which features a 3-foot-tall cloth doll representation of John Evans, who he travelled with throughout his entire tour.
Nice.
I recommend the title track's pretty good if you're into that kind of thing. I enjoyed it anyway. But there you go. So you asked me for something Welsh, and I managed to link Wales and America in a very important way.
Thank you.
And apparently copies of the maps are kept in, there's a museum. They are available to see in a museum. And they are so accurate that it's insane that he was able to be that accurate, because he even sort of sketched what was beyond where he'd been by talking to all the different tribes and sort of working out from their descriptions what they meant. So he was the first person to realise that the Rockies weren't just one mountain range, but were like a collection.
Yes.
Of mountain ranges, which would prove very, very useful. You know, if you're looking for a way to the other side of the Rockies, it's good to know that there are some valleys there that you can kind of cut through.
Except for the Donner Party, who didn't
Except
pay attention.
For the Donner Party, yeah.
Hi there, it's Emma, Chief Organiser at Consistently Eccentric, here to remind you all that if you like what you hear, you can catch up with all previous episodes and session series by searching for us on Acast, Spotify and iTunes. How fancy. You can also join us on Instagram at Consistently Eccentric Podcast, where we update on the weekly episode and post all of our bonus content for you lucky lot. See you next week.